Yes, that was one of our church's favorite songs. We sing that a lot, and we think about what that means to have victory in Jesus. And what would our history be if we didn't have forefathers who claimed that victory, who lived in victory? And what will our future be if we don't have that personal victory? And David, you are forgiven. It may have been my fault. August of 23 years ago, I was asked to teach school in Delta, Colorado. So I had flown out to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and had taken teacher's training, which I think some of you guys are going to be doing here soon. And after I was done there for the week, I flew back to Denver, Colorado, and then there was a shuttle bus, a Greyhound bus, that took us the rest of the way back to Delta or Grand Junction. And so on that bus, there was a number of people. And so I was 19 years old, a stranger, and I don't remember even much about what the conversation was, but I remember the feeling of shock and just alarm of this topic that they were discussing. And I would say, for a bus ride, that was probably one of the worst bus rides that I have ever taken. So yes, the last couple days we looked at a couple parallels of riding a bus and how that is like being a part of a church. A bus can take you part of the way, but you still have to do your part if you want to get all the way to your destination. The bus can provide safe passage, as the same as a church can provide us a safe passage. And one way to determine whether or not the bus is going to take us where we want to go is to simply look at the bus's past record. Has it gone here before? And then we also considered the role of a driver and how it has a large impact on where the bus is going, and also its occupants and how they can have a large impact on your attitude and how you, the impact that they can have on your life. Today, I would like to consider a couple more parallels. And this is the first question. When you're on a bus, how do you know whether or not the bus will take you to your destination? First of all, you need to know where that destination is. Second of all, you can check the map. You can look for road signs as you go by. You can look at the road around you. You need to be alert. You need to see what's happening if you want to know where the bus is going. And you can also consult your fellow passengers and ask them, are we going the right direction? The next question I'd like to consider is, what should we do if you know the bus is going the wrong direction? Probably the first thing we should do is simply pray. But I would say, after that, we should make the driver aware. Do you know that we're going the wrong direction? And then you can show him the map. You can show him the road signs. And if that doesn't work, you can tell your fellow passengers. You can say, do you see what the map says? Do you see the road signs? And maybe together, you can convince the driver that you're going the wrong direction. And then ultimately, if the bus is not going the right direction, if it is not going to go to the destination that you want to go, at some point, there is a time that you need to get off the bus. I'd like to start by considering a few words of warning from the book of Hebrews. Let's turn there, Hebrews chapter 3. I'd like to look at, starting at verse 13, Hebrews chapter 3. Says, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end. We are made partakers. We are made partakers if we hold steadfast. We can be a part of it if we hold on all the way to the end. While it is said today, if ye will hear his voice, harden not your heart, as in the provocation. For some, when they heard, did provoke. Howbeit, not all that came out of Egypt by Moses. But with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? Brothers and sisters, not everyone who left Egypt made it to the promised land. Not every bus and not everyone who has boarded a bus has made it to their final destination. And sadly, not every church and not even every Mennonite church, I believe, has made it to the desired destination. Verse 18, and to whom swear he that they should should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? No. So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Isn't that sad? And then the next verse, chapter 4, verse 1, let us therefore fear lest a promise being left of us entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Do we have a fear of missing the destination that we want to go to? So as I start this talk on history this morning, the last couple days we've looked at some of our more recent history, I would say, starting in the mid to late 1800s, and the revivals that happened. To me, that is a beautiful story of our history. And if that revival could have continued, it would be a blessed story. But not all of those things, as many times happen, continue. And so we're going to look at what happened later on, coming up into the 60s. And so some of the things I share today may be a little more negative. And you know, some of the things that we look at are maybe external things, like dress, how they were dressing. And I want to say from the beginning that those external things are not my focus. And while I believe that the external things, how we practically live the teachings of the Bible, can be a direct indicator of our spiritual life, it is quite possible for us to have all of the external things, we can look right, and yet we cannot have a heart that is living for God. And I want to point to you, especially to you fathers and mothers here today, if we are not living a vibrant Christian life that is led by the Holy Spirit, where the Spirit of God is directing our life, and where it is obvious to our children, then we are wasting our time looking at our history this morning. We're only fooling ourselves to think that we can raise the next generation to serve the Lord, to live godly lives, to live victorious lives, and to be faithful, and we ourselves are not living it. That is foolishness. And there is probably no one here that better knows how you are living than your children. If you are living a life that is a hypocrite, they know it. And so the reality is for us as church leaders and as fathers, we can raise the alarm, but we first must live what we believe. And so as we look at our history, I want to start with that basis and then look ahead at the choices that we make and look back, because choices have consequences. The choices that our forefathers made, the choices that the Mennonite church made in the past affects where we are today. And the choices that we make today will affect our children. And there I point to you, young people. The choices you make today will affect where the church is tomorrow, where your children will be. And so my desire is not to get caught up in all the details of the stories, but to motivate us to consider what are the issues that our children and our grandchildren will look back at this generation and say, I wish my grandparents and my parents had taken a stand on that issue. Or will they, by the grace of God, look back and say, I am so thankful that my parents took a stand on this issue. God help us to have that spiritual discernment. So yesterday we looked at the old order movement and we looked at a number of big issues that were facing them. And then we looked at the Amish Mennonites and the Conservative Conference. And a lot of those things, you know, for the first 20, 30 years, there was a great revival in the Mennonite church, especially up into the 1920s, I would say, even on through that. But what I'd like to look at today is what I would call the conservative Mennonite or conservative Mennonite movement, which is more or less what happened starting in the 50s. And I would say it actually kind of went all the way up even into the 90s, where a lot of people, sometimes it was an individual church, sometimes it was a group of churches, sometimes it was a number of families in a church, but they had to take a stand because of the liberal drift and the influences that were coming into the Mennonite General Conference and later into the Conservative Conference. And they made a distinct turn to a more spiritual lifestyle and a more biblical practice. And so many of these churches, when they left, they did not necessarily go and start a fellowship. I would say most of those churches actually pulled out and became an unaffiliated congregation. And then later on, a lot of them joined together into different fellowships. And hopefully as we discuss this a little more, it will bring you a little more clarity as to how some of that happened. But first of all, I'd like to look at what was happening in the Mennonite Conference, especially in the 60s. And what was happening in the 60s was really simply the effects of what had been going on in the Mennonite Conference for years. Because of what I would say was the inroads and the influence of the teachings of Goshen College and also of man's natural tendency to drift away from God, many of the young people had lost their convictions, and during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, there was a strong push from the conference leaders to rein some of this, what they looked at as apostasy, to rein it in by making more and more rules. And I talked a little bit about the fundamentalist movement. But the reality was, is that because these things were no longer in their hearts and because they were no longer a part of their life, it was when some of these rules relaxed, which is what happened, kind of starting in 1944. And I'll take just 1 minute. If you have these, I don't know. Are there a few more back there on the table? Keith, if you don't have this, we were kind of looking at this timeline. And this is called a timeline of recent Amish Mennonite separations and mergers depicting resistance to and acceptance of mainstream American cultures. And this timeline is not original with me. I was given this topic a number of months ago that I shared in Charlevoix, Michigan. I was given this timeline, and so I tried to track down where that came from, and I found Ernest Eby is the one who made this, and so I asked him for permission to highlight it and share this with you here. So is there anybody who does not have this timeline? Raise your hand. So if you look at number 4 in the blue, kind of there at the bottom, 1944, conferences represented at the Mennonite General Conference chose to fellowship in peace rather than to require each other to meet the expectations agreed upon in the General Conference. And what was happening, they had made all of these rules, but there was a wide range of how administrations from one conference or state to another were enforcing them. In some places, even though it was the rule, people were not even following them, and so it became a big contention in conference. And so at this point, they decided, instead of enforcing it at the General Conference, to let the district conferences enforce it locally. And so shortly after that, especially some of the churches in the West, where it seemed like the liberal drift had started first, they rapidly started to lose their practice. And then we come up into the late 50s and the 60s, and the hippie movement came, and what was affecting the rest of America affected the Mennonite church right along with it. And there's probably some of you older ones here today who remember that, what was going on, but there's probably not very many who were involved at an administration level at that time. Some of you as youth may remember that. But I'd like to tell you, especially some of you young people, some of the stories to give you kind of an understanding of what was happening at that time. And this book here is called God and Uncle Dale. And I'm curious, have any of you young people read this book? So maybe about 25% of you. This book is simply a story of what was happening in the 60s. Dale Eberle, kind of the main character of the story, was a 22-year-old Mennonite boy from Alberta, Canada, and he had been dating a young lady from his church for a number of months, and so they started discussing among themselves some of the practices in the church that they differed on. And one of them at the time was the cape dress. Another one was her size of covering. And he had some concerns. This was his girlfriend. He liked her. But he had some concerns about her and about the direction of the church. And over this time, one Sunday morning, there was a visiting minister that was planning to preach, but before the message, one of the young men, he was a young married man, got up, and he started opening up and confessing to the congregation that he felt like he was living a complacent lifestyle, and he wanted to have a more fervent spirit and serve the Lord. And then after that, his father, who was the bishop of the church, got up and just kind of downplayed what his son had just said. And then he sat back down, and the visiting minister got up and preached a revival, heartfelt message. And after that, one of the young men got up, and he made a public confession that he had been into drinking, he was smoking, And it seemed like that opened up an avalanche of confession. As one after another, the young people started confessing sins of stealing, dishonest business practices, fornication, other immorality. And this was the miracle that Dale had been praying for. This was the revival that he wanted to see in the church. But do you know what happened? Sadly, in a matter of a few weeks, the parents and the ministry squelched that revival. The bishop actually told those in his church that it wasn't even necessary to make restitution. And the parents felt the same way. The reality was, is what the young people were facing and doing and confessing is what their parents were doing, and their parents were not willing to deal with it. In fact, a larger group, later on, a number of the concerned people from that church came to the ministry and you know, shared some of their concerns about what was going on. And initially, they listened to them and it seemed like they supported them. But in the end, what happened is they actually threatened those who came with the concerns, threatened to excommunicate them, and eventually those people left the church. And it split families in the church apart. Dale Eberle, and this is a true story. He and his girlfriend separated, but it was a dramatic time in the Mennonite church. And the thing is that story is not an isolated story. That is what was happening across the Mennonite church, the General Conference, in the Canada and the U.S. during the 50s and 60s especially. This book here is called Passing on the Faith. And this is a history of the Lancaster Mennonite High School. And if you want a visual of what was going on, there's a lot of pictures in this book, and they are dated. And you can see a period of time. If you look at the pictures from about 1965, the people, they could be sitting right up here on these front benches. They look very much like our young people. And in a matter of 10 years, they went, 1975, just looking at the pictures, you can see the progression. They went from that till most of them had just a small little covering. Their hair was cut and flowing down. Some of them did not even have coverings. The boys were playing sports in tank tops and shorts in a matter of just a short amount of time. So that will give you maybe kind of a picture, a visual of what was happening. And this is another book that I have found. This book is maybe specifically about one phase of that. And this is more about a man called Aaron Shank, who was instrumental in bringing the Eastern Conference out of the Lancaster Conference. He was ordained a bishop at 42 years old, which is quite young. And he, in the late 50s, there was a number of churches that had pulled out of the Lancaster Conference, and Roy Geigley, Mervyn Bear, and another number of others, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But Aaron felt like he was ordained and he needed to stay and do his part to bring things together. And he was on the Lancaster Conference Foreign Mission Boards and was made aware that some of the missionaries, in order to adapt to the culture that they were in, were no longer wearing their plain clothes, and they were wearing wedding rings. And so to address this, the leaders there asked him if he would write up an article and send it to them, or a letter and send it to them for concern. And so he wrote it, an article called Marriage and the Wedding Ring, sent it to them, and this is the response that was returned. They said, "We find that we are more effective in our evangelistic efforts using rings than without. We plan to continue using them." And so they did, and it never got addressed. And so Aaron Shank and a number of others, even though they were part of the Lancaster Conference, they had a concern for their youth group, and so they decided to rally a number of people together and to start a Bible school, which was new for them. This was something that didn't happen in their settings, because they wanted something that they could teach their youth the conservative values, the biblical teachings from the Bible. And it seemed like that Bible school became kind of a rallying point for a lot of the others in the Lancaster Conference, especially. And meanwhile, Aaron Shank continued to preach and to sound the alarm in the church. But at one point, it seemed like it just continued to change rapidly. Jewelry was becoming common, cut hair, small coverings. Many of the younger ladies were no longer wearing capes, and their dresses were well above their knees. Movies and television was becoming the normal. And probably, I think the deciding factor, the breaking point for him, was when the church started allowing divorced and remarried people into the congregation. So that was when Aaron Shank came to the conference and simply asked if the conference would allow for them to those who wanted to leave the conference. So there, the conference of 1968, they consented to that. And so what happened in that instance is they went back, the ministry went back to their congregations, and they had a vote. And each of the members could vote whether they wanted to stay or whether they wanted to stay in the Lancaster Conference or join the Eastern Conference. And the ministry also had a decision that they could do that as well. And so if the majority of the congregation wanted to stay in the Lancaster Conference, then those who joined the Eastern had to leave and start a new group. But if the majority of the church wanted to leave and join the Eastern Conference, then they kept that building, and the minority had to leave and either join another church or start a new group. And so there was, in the end, 12 of the churches stayed or left and joined the Eastern Conference, and there was about 55 of the ministry who left as well. So that was kind of what happened in the Eastern Conference, in the Lancaster Conference, when they started the Eastern Conference. But then there was a lot of other churches that were a part of the conference that left and simply were unaffiliated, and they were scattered all across America and Canada. And Wilbur Krupp gave a little history of that. He's one of the bishops from Harrisburg, Oregon. I believe he's gone now. But he was kind of instrumental in organizing a larger fellowship. And I'll explain a little bit of what happened. So his reasons that he gave for withdrawing from the conference lay basically in the development of the powerful executive committee. That was one of the biggest concerns that they saw. When problems arose within the congregations, they would often settle in favor of the liberal element. And when a liberal element split from a local congregation, this move would be supported by allowing them to begin a new congregation close to the old one, and yet they were allowed to remain in the same conference. So the executive committee was not helping them. And one of the other things that was happening too, a lot of the ministry that were in the church had been educated in Goshen College. And initially, a lot of, like in 20s, 30s, a lot of them, men would have had ordained men with a lot, much like our circles would. But later on, going into the 40s, 50s, they started hiring men who had gone to college to be their pastors in the church. And so suddenly that influence became a strong influence in the church. And someone was just giving me an account yesterday of one of these pastors who was trained in college, was actually promoting what was a prominent modernistic theology about, you know, the first 10 chapters in Genesis are not real. They're just figurative. In other words, that the creation was evolutionary and it didn't happen in 7 days. And so this was being promoted from the ministry. And so those were some of the things that they were dealing with. And Wilbur says that the conservative ministers sometimes found their ministry in jeopardy when they opposed those decisions. So in consequence, a number of congregations left the conference and began what was called the Conservative Fellowship. And they, early on, had come up with this paper called The Herald of Truth, which had, ironically, the same name, I would guess, probably by intent. It was a periodical in which conservative voices could once again be heard within the conferences. And as this news got out, there were more congregations that started leaving the conference, and then they started having meetings together here and there to kind of discuss what they were going to do. And in November of 1960, there was a meeting called, guess where? Napanee, Indiana. And it was a meeting for larger scale for a lot of these people to come together. Anyone who is interested in maintaining a biblically conservative position, which the Mennonite Church had always stood for. And so some of the first churches that left the conference probably had the hardest, because those conferences were strong, and if you opposed them, they were quick to excommunicate, or for the leaders, they were quick to put you out of leadership. And so they felt strongly the need to support and to submit. And so it was really hard for them to make the choice to actually leave the conference. I found a program from 1962 titled Continent-Wide Discipleship and Fellowship Meetings. It was held in Shedd, Oregon in August of 1962. And some of the speakers, some of you older ones will recognize, Verton Troyer, Roy Geigley, Harold Kaufman, William McGrath, Mervyn, and Moses Baer. On the bottom of the program, it said, plans are made for a railway coach from Chicago to Oregon. The cost will be about $90 per person round trip. If interested, contact Ernest Bontrager. It's been a little different generation than ours. So in this meeting, there was discussion of a concern for the development of a statement of doctrine for the following reasons: to show that there was a definite doctrinal difference between our position and the apostate trends existing in conferences. There was a need for a basic position in the new movement, for it was drawing away many different people. Perhaps some of them were just disgruntled in their setting. And it was clear it should be a statement of doctrine and not a discipline or a statement of standards for congregations. And so they appointed a committee to write up this statement of doctrine. And that committee was Moses Baer, Roy Geigley, and Wilbur Krupp. And there was a suggestion for them to go back to the Christian fundamentals that I talked about yesterday, what we refer to sometimes as the Garden City fundamentals that were written up in 1921. But because of the rather complicated and lengthy historical introduction to the Dortrick Confession, as used in the previous booklet, it was decided to rewrite it in a more simple and systematic way so that it would better introduce the beginnings of our church to those interested. The historical introduction was intended to cover the apostolic church the development of Catholicism, the Reformation, and the beginning of Anabaptism. The historical writing was assigned to Brother William McGrath, and he came back for review. And the total doctrinal part of this work was then presented at the ministers' meeting held at Sheldon, Wisconsin, the next year, 1963. A number of suggestions and revisions were then brought back to the committee. The committee reworked the original material, or the material, and again presented it to the ministers' meeting in Hartville, Ohio, in 1964. And so there were a few changes suggested, but that statement of practice was approved based on those changes. And that is what a lot of our fellowship churches, I believe the Midwest Fellowship and a number of other fellowships, still use as their statement of faith, from Hartville, Ohio. I'm kind of curious, how many of you know, maybe some of you older ones, if your church would use that statement of faith or in part of your... So there's a few, maybe not a lot. What about the Christian Fundamentals, the one from the Mennonite Conference? Is there any of you would use that here? Okay, so that's probably not the majority of the audience here then. But that would be the Midwest Fellowship, and probably some of the more conservative fellowships, Bethel Fellowship, Western Fellowship, would have that as their statement of faith. So what was the conservative Mennonite Fellowship? So the first three congregations to organize the Conservative Mennonite Fellowship was the Bethel Congregation from Milbank, Ontario, Hartville Conservative from Hartville, Ohio, and the Zion Conservative from Benton, Ohio. So the Bethel Congregation was created from 40 members that had left the conference without any ministry. So because of their concerns, 40 of the members had left and started a new congregation, and later Ken Brenneman was ordained and became their minister. The Hartville, Ohio congregation, the ministry had taken a vote, and the majority of the congregation agreed to leave the conference, so that was how they decided to leave. However, the Zion congregation, the church voted unanimously to leave the conference. And so those three churches were the first three that joined together to start this fellowship, and they all formed in a completely different way. In the next 10 years, there were a number of churches, Hayward, Wisconsin, Sheldon, Wisconsin, Sharon Mennonite from Elida. Those were just a few of the congregations that joined, but there was quite a few that joined. But I'd like to, just for you to kind of get an understand of the sentiment of the fellowship movement, why people wanted a fellowship in contrast to a conference. This is the constitution that they wrote up. Since the Conservative Mennonite Fellowship is not a conference organization with a centralized executive committee or an overall organizational control by one set of standards, which must be identical on every detail, it does not have an explicit constitution. Nevertheless, the fellowship is a voluntary association of independent congregations which recognizes the need of intercongregational counseling and cooperation. And I would say that's a little bit what we have going on here today, right? Or this weekend. In order to work together, the congregations must arrive at a certain mutual understanding. These mutual understandings or guidelines might be called an implicit constitution. For example, if a congregation wishes to affiliate with the CMF, it may call in one or more of our bishops to assist in giving communion once on a trial basis. If it then subsequently decides to continue in fellowship, it must adopt a congregational discipline which is in harmony with the main points of the disciplines of the other congregations in the fellowship. Any congregation in the fellowship is free to discontinue its affiliation at any time, or in turn to be disfellowshipped by the other congregations if it becomes apostate. So for those of you who are part of a fellowship or a conference, that may be interesting to you. I don't know if you're unaffiliated. It may not. I don't know. But that was what they looked for. They didn't want a heavy-handed conference to rule over them. They felt the decisions should be made at a congregational level. And so some of that thought was actually brought into their statement of faith, is my understanding, and which is why the conferences and the fellowships kind of use a different statement of faith. At least that's what I understand. And one thing that I thought was interesting, one of the first things that this new fellowship did is they got together and started a Bible school. They saw a need for a teaching for their young people, and so they started a Bible school, and that later became Messiah Bible School. And a number of the churches, probably the majority of the churches that were a part of that original Conservative Mennonite Fellowship later, that fellowship dissolved, and many of them joined the Nationwide Fellowship. So in 1972, the Southeastern Conference pulled out of the Virginia Conference for much of the same reasons, but that would have been a number of years after the Eastern Conference pulled out. So that was the Southeastern Conference, yeah. So now I'd like to give just a little history of the Midwest Fellowship. There's a number of here from the Bethel congregation and from Traverse City and maybe Charlevoix. So the churches from the Bethel Fellowship came from a wide range of historical backgrounds. Some of them, like the one in Ontario, is actually a split off of the old Waterloo Markham Church, which was an old order group. And there's a book, Midwest has a kind of a history book about them, and you can kind of look through. But some of the churches like Traverse City and the Bethel Church actually came out of the Conservative Conference. So at this time, early 70s, all of these churches were unaffiliated. A few of them may have been a part of the original Conservative Mennonite Fellowship, but that had kind of dissolved. So in October of 1976, there was a number of ministers from these unaffiliated churches that decided to get together about an issue that they were concerned about. It was about a Bible school. They were wanting to start a new Bible school in the Midwest. And so they got together, and a number of those people, I'm sorry, and so they formed a Bible school committee in March of 1977, and that committee proposed starting an association of congregations that would conform to these three principles. Function basically as a congregational type of church administration that recognizes a need for broader sharing. 2, appreciate our Christian heritage as brought to us through the Mennonite Church and are by the grace of God endeavoring to preserve their heritage. 3, accept the Christian fundamentals as adopted in 1964 at Hartville, Ohio, what I just told you about. 4, a commitment to maintain a proper scriptural discipline. So that fourth one is actually added later on. But that was and still is the basic framework of the Midwest Fellowship. And so that Bible school that was started, how many of you know what Bible school that might have been? Maranatha Bible School. How many of you young people have been to Maranatha Bible School? Quite a few of you. I think that's probably kind of what has brought a lot of you guys together here today. But that's what was started there by the Midwest. The interest in starting that Bible school was actually what brought the Midwest Fellowship together, because the Midwest Fellowship actually started later on. But in July of 1977, there was a Midwest Area Fellowship meeting in Kelowna, Iowa. So this was prior to this fellowship being started. And I'd like to give you the names of the speakers on that program. It was Moses Bear from Ontario, Canada, Ernest Bontrager from Estacada, Oregon, Andrew Kaufman from Sheldon, Wisconsin, Elmer Gingrich from Uniontown, Ohio, Edwin Knepp from Macon, Mississippi, Dan Schrock from Hayward, Wisconsin, Floyd Miller from Goshen, Indiana, Olin Miller from Shoals, Indiana, Dale Oswald from Milford, Nebraska, Yuri Sharp from Hartville, Ohio, and Dan Beiler from Seymour, Missouri. So many of you come from maybe different directions, but you probably recognize a few of those names. Andrew Kaufman was my great-grandfather. Ernest Bontrager was instrumental in starting the Western Fellowship. Dan Beiler was instrumental in starting the Bethel Fellowship. So all of these men were part of these unaffiliated churches, and they got together for this big fellowship meeting in Kelowna, Ohio. And in September 1977, the ministry met again, and that's when they formed the association. It strongly carried to name it Midwest Mennonite Fellowship, and in October, they decided to lease a school building in Lansing, Minnesota, and the next February and March of 1978, they had a six-week Bible school, and they called it Maranatha Bible School. So some of the men that were instrumental were the first ones in starting the Midwest Fellowship was Glenn Schrock, Marvin Troyer, Roman Slaybaugh, Ken Brenneman, Homer Miller, Floyd Miller, and a number of others. Ministry were there. But there were 14 churches that were charter congregations of the Midwest Fellowship, including Bethel here in Napanee, Indiana, Canaan, Indiana, Hillside Shoals, Seney, and Traverse Bay from Michigan, Northwoods, Buck Creek, and Wilson congregations from Wisconsin, Hartville, Sunlight, Gospel Light, from Ohio, Prairie from Minnesota, and Heidelberg and Grace from Ontario. So I'd like just to take a little bit more time to just look at the diagram there. And someone commented, well, a number of people have commented about why do we have all of these fingers? And I don't know if I have a good answer for that, but one answer I would have is that there were a number of reasons when people left the conference, they didn't all leave at one time and join one group. They left over a period of, like I said, 50 years, and you can kind of see that by when a lot of these churches formed. As the conference progressed, And they didn't necessarily all progress at the same time, and the conservative conference was kind of progressing or degressing, maybe about 20 years behind the Mennonite General Conference. And so when they pulled out, that was at a different time. And so even the churches here that are unaffiliated, your time frame in that was probably, somewhere in there too. So the non-conference fellowships, you see that it starts out blue and it ends up green. And the reason I did that is because the non-conference fellowships were not necessarily from the general conference or from the conservative conference. They were from a mix of them. And they were, just like the Midwest Fellowship, they came from different areas, and they had a same common goal that they united around. And so I would say the fact that the fellowship formed actually was more of a pulling together than a dividing. And yes, I think some of the conferences maybe did divide later on, so there was some of that. And so some of that did happen. But the non-conference fellowships would include like the Nationwide, Bethel, Western, Midwest Fellowship. There's a number of those. And that started in the 1960s. 1968 was when the Eastern Pennsylvania conference started. And then you see 1978, the Mid-Atlantic Fellowship. This shows that it came out of the Eastern Conference. I think probably one of the original leaders did actually leave with the Eastern Conference and then later kind of didn't feel comfortable with the direction of that. And so they kind of maybe took a more moderate approach. And after that, there was a number more that came out of the Lancaster Conference and joined them. So that kind of, you could have maybe two arrows that could have come from the Eastern and the General Conference, the Lancaster Conference. And then the Southeastern Conference, 1972. And then all the way down in 1999, another group pulled out of the Lancaster Conference, the Keystone Fellowship. And that same year, what we would know as BMA, the Biblical Mennonite Alliance, pulled out of the Conservative Conference. So that maybe kind of gives you a little more of a picture. There's a lot of information, but hopefully you kind of understand and give you a little bit of clarity where your church might fall in that. So I'd like to take... there was one other thing I was going to point out in there, and that was the purple there. In 1999, it says, the merger between the Mennonite Church and the General Conference Mennonites to form MCUSA. And so what happened is, I was telling you about the General Conference and the Mennonite General Conference, the old Mennonites and the new Mennonites. Actually, 150 years after they separated, they merged again. So, but what do they stand for? I think if you would look at their confession of faith, it's worded very carefully, and there's probably not a lot in there that you and I would disagree with. But how they live that out, I would say, is far from scriptural. They're ordaining gay and lesbian pastors, sanctioning abortion, and sadly, they're a dying church. It seems like many of those churches are losing their membership, and they have lost their message. They have gone so far that far from the truth that they really have no message. So I'd like to consider, what is the trajectory of the Conservative Fellowship Movement? So all of these churches pulled out, we call that the Conservative Fellowship Movement. If you consider 1960 as the beginning, we are about 65 years into that movement. If you go back about 65 years from there, we're looking at 1900, which was right around the time of the revival and the formation of the Mennonite Conference. The John Kaufman's revival probably started about 15 years before that. So there's quite a range of thought, practice, in those who have pulled out, even among those churches that have pulled out as a part of that movement. And I want to challenge you young people here today, and this isn't just for you young people. Do you think that you have the same vision that those men that pulled out of those conference churches, do you think that you have the same vision for the church that they had? And if you don't have that same vision, what do you think is different? What is your vision for the church? If you continue with the same spiritual depth in your relationship with God, if you have the same amount of victorious Christian living, the same level of obedience to God, if you have the same convictions, the same personal commitment to your brotherhood, and if you maintain the same application of the principles of God's word, will that trajectory get you to where you want the church to go in 70 years from now? And as parents, do you have a vision for the spirituality of your family? Do you want your children to live out the teachings of God's word, or are you just moving along with whatever is happening next? What attitudes and what ideas are we allowing to be fed into our homes? Do we take time to stop and think what the end result of those decisions will be? How does a church go from upholding a biblical practice and over a period of time completely abandoning it? I think it's important that we think about these things. I think probably all of us could point to someone that we knew in the past that professed to live a holy life and live out these biblical principles, but we can look at them today and they're anything but scriptural. Some of them are divorced and remarried or otherwise. How does that happen? I think that many of these things are major, many of these major issues are often a result of a heart that was maybe at one time connected to the source, but somehow they have lost their connection with God. And sadly, that the tendency of application and living out our scriptural principles tends to go one way. It seems like we tend to lose our vision. And there are times when people stand up and take a stand and maybe pull back a little bit. But I think often it is a continued trend that leads a group to eventually abandon that position, which is often the result of complacency. If we want to keep a scriptural application, we need to be intentional. We need to take times like this to look at our past and to look at the examples of others and to stop and to consider the direction that we're going. It has been said, and I quote, "The specific application is not the problem, but the progression of change in application that speaks to the problematic issue of direction." Did you follow that? It is the direction that we are going. Do you know where the bus is going? And are you sure that bus is going to get you to the next generation, to the next destination? And what about the next generation? Chester Weaver says, our conservative Mennonite groups are at an identity crisis again. We need men who are willing to look at our history and to see what happened so that we do not repeat those mistakes again. Chester Weaver grew up in the Lancaster Conference. He was there at the Lancaster High School. He saw those things happen firsthand. He says that he is hearing some of those same thoughts, ideas, and even some of the same terms that were being used in the 60s. And I'm going to quote him. He said, "We don't have television, but we have movies and internet, which provide pornography just as bad or worse than what television did. There are so many young people that are involved in pornography. If we don't deal with that, we are not going to make it. We have head coverings shrinking again. Another thing is becoming a part of the political process. That is a total loss of the two-kingdom concept. Back in those days, sports became important, and now we have sports becoming important again. You look at people's heroes, you find out where they are. If you have sports heroes and national heroes, and you don't have Christ and Christian history heroes, you know where people are," end quote. Gary Miller, in his book, The Other Side of the Wall, asked this question: why did so many Mennonite churches after the revival of the late 1800s lose their separation from the world, non-resistant principles, and many other clear script teachings of Scripture? And this is his conclusion. He says, it was a direct result of who they were following. Rather than go back to the Bible and a historical example of the Anabaptist revival, which called believers to live out the teachings of Jesus Christ, these men began to imitate the methods and theology of their Protestant neighbors. Instead of emphasizing a changed life by following Jesus, the focus shifts to what a person knows and believes about him. This subtle change may not seem important, but the consequences were drastic and had huge ramifications. Suddenly, living out the teachings of Jesus did not seem nearly as important as how much Bible knowledge you had attained. Modern Christianity shifted from focusing on a change in life to a change in belief. This change of focus is huge, and I believe it is the underlying root cause of the doctrinal slide. Brothers and sisters, from my perspective, there were six major issues that the Mennonite church faced in the end of early 1900s, end of the 1800s. It was whether they should speak the English language, whether they should have revival meetings, Sunday schools, missions, whether they should have higher education. I believe that they got all of them right, but one. And this is my perspective, this is my opinion. I believe they got all of them right, but one. The influence of Goshen College, and I don't believe that it was the education so much as the influence, changed the young people, it changed the hearts of the Mennonite, of the young people, and eventually they lost their young people. One of the reasons 60 years ago why our forefathers pulled out of the conference and took a stand is because they saw the influences that were coming in from not only from Goshen College, but from television and radio and some of these other things that were bringing influences into their homes. My challenge is, what influences are coming into our churches? What are we feeding on today? If we see the dangers of the influence that Goshen College had on the Mennonite church, and we are sitting here feeding on some of the exact same influence from Satan's kingdom, and we have it in our pockets, in our homes, and we don't realize that that is a danger. And I don't know. There's a lot of issues, I would say, in our world. But if I had to say that there is one issue that we may look back in 50 years and say, yes, we got that right, or yes, we missed that, I would propose that that issue is our stand on technology and social media and smartphones and what we're feeding on. And that is my opinion. And now I want to talk to you young people. I come to you not from one who has it figured out. I come from my own testimony, is that I, because of technology, lived a life of sin for way too long. And I realized the dangers. And my commitment to you, especially you young boys, I want to come alongside and help you find the accountability, the barriers. I want to come and help you through this. We need fathers who are committed to their young people to see the dangers that this is facing, that this is bringing to you. We can't come from a point of having this all figured out, and you need to figure it out, because we haven't figured it out. I'm afraid there's too many of dads and others my age who have who have failed you. And my commitment is not to condemn you, but to come alongside. If you're struggling with some of these things, I have been there. But by the grace of God, I have found victory. And that is my testimony. There is victory in living for the Lord Jesus. And when I found true accountability and commitment, God gave me victory over that. And you can find that. But you need to. It is an evil, and there is so much. And it's not just young men. Young ladies, it is real. The dangers on that and the influence that is bringing into your life. And it's not just the pornography. Yes, that is a big one. But we're feeding on the world's ideas. We're looking at YouTube. We're looking at the NFL highlights. We're looking at the weight loss programs. We're looking at these America's Got Talent. And, you know, we can say, what's wrong with these? But who's feeding that kingdom? And I'm with you. I'm not condemning you. But my cry is, we need to take this seriously. What are we going? Are we fooling ourselves to think that we can continue to feed on this and we're going to live victorious, vibrant Christian lives and we don't even have time? I remember 20 years ago sitting in the office listening to my fellow workers talking about what they watched on TV and how much time they were on TV up till midnight. And I'm like, where did you find time to do that? And now, to my shame, I find myself, what? Spending time scrolling. Doing the exact same thing that I saw them doing. And I challenge us. And I'm Brother Japheth, sorry, I hope I'm not taking over your topic. But it is a serious one, and it is dear to my heart. And that's why I plead with you, young people, go to your ministry. If they're not here, they need you. We need each other. We can get through this, but we need to look at it seriously. And by God's grace, we can have young people who are living vibrant Christian lives. We need the zeal and energy of young people. We need people who want to serve the Lord. We need young people who are sold out for Christ, not interested in what the world has to offer, but interested in living a life for Jesus, humble, broken, and surrendered. And young people, we need moms and dads, grandpas and grandmas, who are willing to model that for you. 1 Corinthians 12:2 says, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God, which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they're foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they're spiritually discerned. But he that is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is judged of no man. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. Brothers and sisters, we have the mind of Christ. When this becomes a part of us, we have the mind of Christ. And as we reflect today on what we have learned, and when we look ahead to where our churches are going, may each of us have a vision. God, help us to have the boldness and the strength to step out and make the changes that will lead to revival and a path of faithfulness. And God, help us to have the wisdom and courage to avoid the changes that will destroy our children. And God, help us to have the discernment to know the difference. May each of you have the mind of Christ.